by her, but also very excited to have her on our live. So we're having today Alice Wilby. And Alice is such a sustainability champion that I couldn't, you know, just it's gonna take me quite a while to describe everything that she does, but just to mention a few things. So she's a sustainable fashion stylist and creative director, also the co-founder of Novo Approach, which is a sustainable creative fashion agency. But also Alice is a tutor at the Central St. Martin's in London, teaching about sustainability in fashion. And she's also very often on BBC TV and the radio as a sustainable fashion expert. And today we have her live with us. So I'm super excited to have her on. Awesome. Well, for the second time since we were doing these lives for like 4 months, I have the house to myself. So I was able to switch place, because normally I'm like stuck between two shelves in my bedroom, but now I have a little bit of a nicer wall behind me. So super nice to have you. Happy that the internet worked out, and I hope that you're able to go out a little bit now. Did they loosen the lockdown a little bit?
Yeah. It's been very strange, because I think we're being led by Boris Johnson, who's an absolute idiot, and he's just kind of like giving misinformation left, right and centre. I mean, he's not leading us. He's kind of standing in front of us, sort of telling us what to do and then what not to do. And it's really kind of confusing. So you can go out, people can go out. Our local park has turned into kind of like everybody's front room. It's actually quite nice to see, like, now people can gather again. You've got sort of all multi-generation families hanging out in the park and having fun, which is really lovely. But yeah. We can go out, but there's nowhere to go out to. Nothing has reopened. I mean, the shops have reopened, but, you know, there's nothing to... You can't go to your favourite restaurant, and we're all sort of worried about our lovely local Italian down the road that's been, you know, sort of family-run for the last 30 years, and everyone's keeping their fingers crossed that they'll come back, but...
So they've fully closed, they're not doing home delivery or something like that?
They've started doing pizza delivery, which is really good. But I know that the father of the family who runs it, pizza isn't his favourite thing to cook, so it's not necessarily good for him, but it's good for us. So fingers crossed they will have their doors open again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And were you able to go swimming? No?
Not yet. I've been too busy. I've got, I think I was telling you about we had a local swimming pond that opened up down the road here, and that's remained closed. But friends of mine who live in Hackney have been going swimming in the rivers in the river in Hackney Marshes, and it's incredibly beautiful. If you check out a photographer called Tom Hunter, he does these beautiful, it's an amazing photographer, but he's been taking beautiful pictures of people swimming there, and it just looks, his work is wonderfully lit and sort of rather like the old master's paintings, just incredibly beautiful, really atmospheric. And he's captured friends and family swimming there, and I keep looking through his Instagram account, just kind of like desperate to go over there and plunge in. So I think that will be my, when I get a minute to escape on the bike.
Awesome. Yeah, I just texted it here as a comment. I think maybe, hopefully I spelled it correctly.
Yes.
Yeah, so yes. Tom Hunter, everyone, if you feel like checking out some beautiful photography, that's your man. I'm definitely going to. I have to say to the people who are watching that we had a previous call, and the reason I know that Alice loves swimming is because my son appeared on my background, like completely naked with just a towel, and we had to kind of find our way out of this awkward situation. So we discussed swimming habit, which, thank you so graciously, managed well. Yeah. So the thing that we actually had two topics, obviously sustainability is one of them, and this is our core and main thing that we like to talk about on these live sessions, looking at it from different angles. But I just want to touch on something else that is now kind of the main topic, I think, for so many people, especially in the US, but also in the UK and other countries. And it was racial equality and how we treat each other as human beings. And I think I just want to, you know, have the floor to have a discussion on this, because I feel, as I told you, I feel very awkward, and at some point I know and I want to do something to change the narrative, and I know that I want to be active in saying things that I see that are not the right things, and somehow I also feel a little bit restrained by just, you know, not having lived in precisely that problem, so I don't really know that much about it on the inside. So I don't want to be offensive or just completely out of course. So what is the current mood in the UK, you think?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think what has been very interesting. I mean, it's heartbreaking that another black man had to die in order for us to be globally having such a huge conversation about human rights and civil rights and the Black Lives Matter campaign, which is obviously of vital importance. It's heartbreaking that we need it, but you know that we are stuck in a system that is that has been built structurally off the, especially in fashion. The fashion industry is built on the back of slavery and exploitation. And it's, you know, from its roots in the Industrial Revolution and colonial past, it's steeped in exploitation and subjugation of black and brown people. And you know, the legacy is intrinsically embedded in the industry. I mean, if you look at how brands have been treating their supply chain workers at the beginning of the COVID breakout, without using to pay for orders, and then at the same time doing lots of kind of like bank holiday weekend promotions to get people to kind of like come and go shopping. Yeah. And then when the Black Lives Matter movement came to the fore again, were posting lots of sort of solidarity posters or posts on their Instagram account whilst simultaneously refusing to pay their workers in Bangladesh. So the messaging is completely askew, and it just really highlights how we're operating in this kind of like structurally racist, oppressive system. And I think what has happened is that it's brought a lot of people have been forced very quickly to consider their place in this, how they are implicated in it, what they can do, what they haven't been doing, how can we do more, how can we learn, how can we understand, how can we be allies, how can we be active accomplices, how can we stand up and help and fight and call out the systemic racism that we see all around us that's holding our friends and our colleagues back. And I think I think people are too scared to talk about it because sometimes it can feel quite a prickly conversation, and rather than not wanting to get involved, of or worry of saying the wrong thing. But this is, again, it just, in our silence, if we are silent, we become complicit. If we don't say anything and we don't start questioning things, we become complicit with the oppressor. It's the same in any kind of abusive, bullying, exploitative situation that you might encounter, from really intense systemic racism through to watching somebody be bullied in the workplace, if we don't stand up and speak out. And I think the best thing to do, one of the best things to do, is to take this time to, if you feel that you haven't been as knowledgeable as you could have been, there are so many amazing, amazing people speaking out and amazing people with using their platforms to communicate. And so we are not short of resources. Like, the ignorance is not bliss. It's no longer, it cannot be an excuse for not educating us.
Absolutely.
It's okay to say, I need to know more and I need to learn more. I mean, I'm a middle class white woman. I've been working in sustainable fashion for 10 years and I have been trying as hard as, I've felt that I've been trying as hard as I could when I've had opportunities to fight for diversity, when I've been casting models for campaigns, when we've been doing creative direction for brands. And some brands have been really receptive and really understand and really kind of instantly get it. And other brands have been very resistant.
Did you have this experience where you would pitch a more diverse cast and the company would just say, we haven't really thought about it, like it didn't even occur?
Yeah, a couple of times. And some people have, I've heard arguments to say that that's not our customer base. So it's not our customer. Our customer, we have a predominantly white customer base. So why should we?
How do we know what kind of customer we have when all of the media, all of the, with very few exceptions, right? You would have maybe one black model for diversity, but could we say that black people don't buy Gucci or they don't buy Louis Vuittons or they don't buy...
Nonsense. It's absolute nonsense, isn't it? It's what we are seeing is a very narrowed down view that's come from a sort of a very, very white majority industry. Like the majority of people in the fashion industry in positions of power are white. A lot of them are male. Yeah. There are only a couple of creative directors at major brands that are black. I think they're both men. They're both men, and it's a very difficult industry to get into, full stop. And so, even if we are seeing brands having, and there's been so much tokenism for years, having a token person of color in their campaign.
Yes.
If they are not reflecting that diversity within their company, within their HR, within their hiring procedures, within the way that they support and nurture black talent and BAME talent, if they're not supporting people throughout the entire creative process in their company, then it's meaningless. It's really meaningless, because it's an aggression all in itself, because it's a kind of a suggestion that you are, that we're kind of catering to you and we sort of see you, but actually really when it comes down to it, you're not welcome. And that's really what we've got to fight. But it comes all the way through from education as well, ensuring that we get as a diverse student population as possible. And that was in the UK here, we've had real problems with education becoming very elitist as soon as they made it, £9,000 a term to study.
Yeah.
So that instantly narrows it down to a very kind of like small focus of globally very affluent students. And that's, not necessarily just from a white background, but you instantly have a student population that that is very narrow in its selection pool.
Yeah.
When I went to university, I studied photography at London College of Printing
Don't worry. It's okay.
Nearly 20 years ago, I think.
Uh-huh. Oh, I'm with you.
And then it was free. We didn't have to pay. You had to be able to afford to study. You had to be able to either, have a job.
Support yourself through studies, right?
But there was such a rich melting pot of students from a real diverse section of backgrounds. And it was a really real opportunity for people from other walks of life to meet. And really importantly, really crucially, creatively, but across any field, to meet people that you might not have met in the small village that you grew up in, or the girls' school, or the boys' school that you went to, or the comprehensive that you went to, or the city that you lived in, to kind of meet people from different walks of life and find out about them. People from different countries, people from different cultures, people from different ethnicities.
Ethnicities, yeah.
It's really, really vital to...
You are now an educator yourself, right? You teach sustainable fashion. And what do you think, first of all, what is your audience at the moment? Who are the people who are interested in sustainable fashion? Is this like a entry course, or what kind of people do you see coming to your course?
Our course is interesting because it's a short course, so we don't have any entry requirements other than you can attend and that you care and that you turn up and you're engaged and interested and passionate. So we teach short courses at St. Martin's, myself and Claire Farrell. And it's a real wide section. Claire's been teaching it for 10 years. I joined her a few years ago. And even when she started teaching it, there were a lot of students who'd come from other courses who hadn't got the grounding in sustainability when they were studying and wanted to learn. And I mean, 10 years ago, sustainability wasn't really embedded in the curriculum at all. So she was seeing a lot of students coming from other courses who wanted more information. And then since I've been teaching, we've seen a massive rise in people from brands who are, I mean, we have people from fast fashion brands who come, and we have people from luxury brands who come. And what is really interesting, and they're from a variety of sectors within those brands. So we have people from marketing, and we have people who are managing supply chains and distribution, and we have independent designers. We still have students. So it's a real kind of, there's always one person who isn't in the fashion industry at all. Like, we often have an accountant or a lawyer or somebody who's kind of like, you know, interested in sustainability and sustainable fashion and wants to change profession. But increasingly people are coming with more knowledge, and increasingly people are coming because they are frustrated with the mainstream system, and they're frustrated with mass production and the kind of like corporate system that they're stuck in, and they want a way out. So this is our sort of, it's an introduction to sustainability, to give people a broader horizon and a kind of a way out of the mainstream, which is what you took.
Yeah, it is from my personal story, right? It is a way out of the mainstream, which is a tough choice, I guess. And for me, it meant losing a lot of comfort in my pretty little place. But it is very interesting to think of how and what is the management level especially in fast fashion companies, of people who are realizing that some change is needed. Because as I mentioned in our previous conversation, we spoke to companies like ASOS and Marks and Spencer and John Lewis, and we see that those retailers are realizing that they need to change. Now, change in the scale of organization that they are is a rather hard thing to do, not impossible, but I mean, they are making some amends to get there and trying to find the right way that's going to work for them. But that said, there is not really like a very good plan how to transition your company and change it. There is no framework for creating actionable strategy that you can actually execute and get from point A to point B. So, you know, I think even though I would like to say that all of these companies are very bad and hurting the planet, I also have to realize that from a business standpoint, they need to transition. That's a hard thing to do. And also, I'm not sure that all levels of their management are on board with that. Not in most of those companies, right? So we would see like mid-level management people who are kind of realizing and they want to do some change, and then they would start running some projects internally, and then those projects will just die out or, you know, hit a wall. There is a question here that I want to read. Let me just see it. Oh. Okay, so any recommendations for where to find sustainable, eco-friendly fabrics, suppliers and manufacturers in the UK, I believe it was, in the UK and Europe?
Yes, so I would suggest going to, you've got the sustainable angle and Offset Warehouse, who are fantastic for fabric and materials. And then you would want to sign up, I don't know if you're already a member of Common Objective. And they are a platform, an organization that is dedicated to connecting people in sustainable fashion, sustainable communication, manufacturing, the entire gamut. So you sign up, you create your profile, and you literally sort of like select, you list what you're doing, you select who you want to be, what kind of businesses you want to be connected with, and then you start building your network. And I think it's a really fantastic resource. I mean, it's a brilliant resource, but it's also a really great company to support. So I would advise going there. Common Objective.
Okay, super. Also, there is a company called Supply Compass. They're also doing a great job in helping smaller brands just build a more sustainable supply chain that is, controlled end to end, which is it is a struggle, I think. As we discussed in our call before, we know that most of the retailers don't really know their supply chain, even the big ones and even the ones that claim that they want to know, and kind of maybe they know the first two tiers of the supply chain, and then it's all gone. So yeah, I think what we are trying to do now with the Impact ID that we are developing, of just bringing, some sort of equality in the way that we measure impact of fashion items, just across the landscape, across regardless of the brand or retailer, just a way for consumers to kind of realize the impact of what they're consuming and maybe take also some action to mitigate it. Because I think once you know, for example, that you're, let's say that you've purchased products that generated 500 kilograms of CO2, there are ways to mitigate that. You can donate to organizations who plant trees, or support woods or green life. And so there are ways that you can actually do something to kind of clean up the footprint that you've left. Clean water projects, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm going to be a real Grinch and say that we have to really tackle the elephant in the room, which is our consumption habits. And
Yes.
we have to start consuming less, we have to start producing less. And so this is a kind of big concern of mine at the moment, that we are witnessing another type of greenwashing when we talk about offsets and we talk about engaging the consumer with engaging the consumer with offsetting their
Sure.
carbon, their consumption habits, because
Yeah.
we live on a planet of finite resources and we're consuming like they're infinite. And
Yeah.
it's, we cannot keep going with this business model of constant turnover and consumption, and
Yeah.
this linear model of making things, using them, consuming them, and then throwing them away.
Yeah,
So
I completely agree. And also, there needs to be, we cannot also rely on a business organization to regulate themselves, right?
got to
So
have,
some,
yeah.
yeah. So I completely agree on that point. And I think for me, like, thinking on this concept and developing it, the way we've approached it, or at least I have approached it, is by researching different ha habit building strategies on a pure psychological level and how that could turn around. And so for me, I think if we approach it the way we've approached smoking, or the way we've approached healthy food habits, right? It is a question of getting information, and that once this information sinks into your brain, at some point you kind of start making a conscious decision of, because for example, with smoking, all right, it is important to have these ugly pictures on the
packet, yeah.
packages, yeah, but also it means a lot when it's forbidden to smoke pretty much everywhere, and you cannot smoke while you're eating, and you cannot smoke while you're having a drink with your friend. And then at some point, it just makes no sense to smoke anymore because, well, all the social part of smoking is gone, so you can only be smoking by yourself. And so,
What you're touching on here is also is health, and
yeah.
it's our health. And I think this is something that we don't talk about much in the fashion space. to do with consumption is mental health and how this pressure to constantly consume and constantly buy things and constantly be getting something new and engaging with a different thing for a moment and then kind of getting rid of it. And it's just, there's a, you know, there's a whole generation of people younger than myself, kind of digital natives, who are kind of growing up traumatized because they're constantly being told that they are, they're not happy and they need something new, and they're not happy and they need to be, their attention needs to be diverted and they need to kind of like buy into something else. And I find it incredibly damaging. And we can't fight the climate crisis. We can't fight racial inequality. We can't fight this kind of and demand systemic change, which is what we desperately need. We need to rip down this system that we're in and build ourselves a new one. And that has to come from a really holistic place. It has to come from a really kind of like wraparound 360 place. Because if we're not healthy and we're not happy, we're not able to take care of ourselves, we're not able to take care of each other, respect each other and respect the planet. And it kind of, it all needs to happen together. We can't segment it. We can't segment anything anymore.
Yeah, I
don't know how to. This is my big kind of question at the moment. Is like, how do we fight the power of the fast fashion brand? How do we fight Boohoo? How do we fight a company like that that's currently buying up our high street? The owner of Boohoo said at the end of last year that he doesn't consider what they do to be fashion because it's so disposable. I mean, they just make like plastic clothing. It's disposable plastic clothing, and he says it's not fashion. So we have to understand that when we're dealing with these, I mean, it's not fashion. I can see the hearts coming in. It's not fashion, is it? It's rubbish. But with that, the power that they have as a brand to influence young hearts and minds is really terrifying. And we have to look. We have to kind of like pull out and look at this structure in which he's working, which is just exploitation the entire way through, from the resources that they take from the planet that are considered disposable through to the workers that the, you know, certain brands are still currently not paying in Bangladesh, through to the consumer who is just treated as a kind of as a cash cow at the end of the production line. And he's built a multinational company that's got very little to do with fashion and culture, and much more to do with exploitation. And we need to address it.
Yeah, we had a live with Christina Dean, which I know you know, and she mentioned that she was for years hoping and thinking that we as consumers, with the cash that we spend, we could turn things around. And that's a great tool to actually moderate the situation, which in fact is working to some extent, and we see some brands really feeling the heat from their consumers kind of pulling back, but on the other hand, it cannot only remain at that, because there are many tools which companies exploit to just get you in the rat race again. And so I think regulation on the national but also on the global scale is very, very crucial and important. And not regulation like we agree that in 20 years from now we are going to be sustainable, but regulation like you cannot use this type of material, like single-use plastic needs to be forbidden. And we see that across so many countries in Europe, which is great. A little bit late, I would say, but I mean better late than never. But we need to see that in fashion as well. So there are materials that we should just simply stop using, and they should not exist, and we need to find other ways. Or maybe we need to build a framework to dispose of items. And so we need to go back to the way we design and produce things that can be then either circulated, completely recycled, or they're produced in a way that's not harmful to nature, and you can actually throw them and they will biodegrade by themselves, and it doesn't take them 400 years. It takes them, you know, maybe a year or two. So I think regulation is a huge part of it. However, I just don't really see that. And again, it is a little bit of a greenwashing on all of those NGOs who are in it and having this really top line discussions and talking about the great goals. But then what are the What are the actions that we need to take other than talking about it? Because obviously talking about it, you know, it's great and we feel good about ourselves in for 5 minutes and then nothing happens. And so we need to take some action. We need to
This
build
is why
framework.
the brands. This is why we have to push for legislation. This is why we have to demand this really radical systemic change. Because when we put the onus on the consumer to do something, the consumer does a couple of makes a couple of a few small tweaks to their lifestyle, which they might actually find quite difficult, like giving up smoking or giving up fast fashion, stopping using single-use plastic, and they feel really good for a few minutes. Or they might really feel the danger is that they feel so satisfied that that's all they do and they just keep on operating like that. Meanwhile, all of the massive companies, these huge, like multinational companies, and take fashion out of the equation because it's all of these consumables that we interact on a daily basis are going largely unchecked. And we, you know, these huge polluters are getting away with absolute murder. It's like a sleight of hand magic trick. Whilst we are over here doing something kind of like really good and feeling really, really pleased with ourselves, these polluters are getting away with literally with murder. So it has to come from a legislation point. And I think, again, I have to kind of bring this back to the climate and ecological emergency that we're currently in. And we have a very limited period of time in which to kind of get some working solutions in place to tackle the climate crisis because, you know, as I say with our activist work, there's no fashion on a dead planet. There's no family on a dead planet. There's no swimming on a dead planet. There's, you know, remove fashion and slot in whatever it is you love into that space. And so when you kind of view things, when you really look at the science, and for anyone who's interested in this and not quite sure, and overwhelmed with all the information, Greta Thunberg has just put out a new podcast, which really beautifully top lines a lot of this information, including talking about feedback loops and the dangers of those. And we're already starting to see feedback loops taking effect.
What is a feedback loop?
So there are a series of tipping points that we really want to try and avoid, and the melting of the Arctic ice being one, for example, because as soon as the ice is gone for kind of longer periods of time, all of that white blanket of snow reflects all of the sun's rays back into the environment and stops the earth from warming, basically. And as soon as that's gone, then we start to see the darker earth underneath and the water absorbing more heat. And then once that happens, it kicks off something else that kicks off something else. And we get stuck into a series of feedback loops from which there is no man-made intervention anymore. And this is, you know, I think we're at about 1.2 degrees of warming at the moment. The Paris Agreement has stipulated that we have to stay below 1.5 de degrees of global heating in order to protect life on Earth. And though you know, it's overwhelming. I'm sitting here sort of, you know, sweating in this 30 degree heat in my sitting room in London, fully aware that we're in the middle of a heat wave. And meanwhile, the Arctic is currently experiencing 45 degrees of temperature at the moment, which is kind of like the sort of hottest period recorded, I believe, in history. So we're currently witnessing some really kind of frightening weather patterns. And so when we look at before I start rambling on this, I would direct people to go and listen to this podcast by Greta because she's much more eloquent on this subject than I am. And what we really need to do is we really need to look at the science. We really need to be led by the science. This is something she's been asking people to do, you know, all along with her campaigning. And when we start to look at the science and we look at the limited amount of time that we've got left to affect really radical change, we realize that engaging consumers with not using single-use plastic is a moot point, compared with all of the industrial waste that we see industry producing. So it comes back again to calling on governments to tell their citizens about the climate crisis, convene people's assemblies so that people can come and take part in it and consider as a community what we want to do, and push for legislation, back to legislation again. So it's a, I find myself in a really funny position with this because I've been campaigning for people to buy sustainable fashion for 10 years. And I'm finally, we're finally at a point where people are buying sustainable fashion and they're getting really engaged with it and really enjoying it. But for me, sustainability and ethics, it was always rooted in the ethical treatment of people and planet and creating an industry that sustained itself. And if we keep producing, buying and consuming sustainable fashion in a mainstream fashion mold, then we've completely missed the point and we're just contributing to the problem rather than actually contributing something to fix it.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe that COVID is a nice wake up call for all of us. I don't know about you, but I've never, I didn't experience the urge to buy anything really other than food and not even food over the last 4 months. And so I'm a relatively moderate consumer. I don't really like to buy a lot of things, but now I really didn't have the need. So I'll just, you know, just buy some vegetables and let it be. And I felt really great about it. And I think so many people have realized that they don't really need all these things that they actually own. I think you are running a sustainable creative agency. And what exactly is it?
Well, I haven't, just to your point about not buying anything, I haven't bought anything for a year. I haven't bought any new clothes for a year, and I've got my eye on something at the moment that I might break. I've done a year. I might break my fast, and I tell you what I actually do need is a total aside. And I really agree with you. I think it's been a really interesting space for people to step back and realise that they don't need a load of crap. That actually we need to cherish what we've already got, and this is the most sustainable. You know, to quote Ursula de Castro, the most sustainable item of clothing you have is the one that you already own. And we need to engage people with really caring about their clothing. But yeah, I've been during lockdown, the government sanctioned walks that we were, the exercise that we were allowed to take every day became a real treasure to me. And it became something that I've always loved being in nature. Like most of us, we forget about it when we're living in cities. And so taking these wonderful walks, and the thing I've realized that I really actually do need to buy and really want to buy is a proper 100% like mountain kind of standard waterproof jacket. this is the one thing I can, and some proper walking boots, because I've got wellies and I've got some like sort of walking boots in the style of walking boots from Pozu, but yeah. Actually, really need is a really hardcore waterproof jacket from Patagonia, and I need some really sturdy walking boots, because that's the piece of kit that is genuinely missing from my wardrobe. that's been my kind of like realization after lockdown. The thought of going out and buying a waterproof, like a warm waterproof jacket at the moment in this heat is completely insane. But yeah, we do novel. It's a novel. A novel approach is my creative space with my business partner Candice Joni, and she is an amazing artist, and she is a makeup artist and just kind of all round creative genius. And we met 7 years ago on a job, and I'd left Eco Age and I was looking for an agent. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I was kind of like back to styling and working sustainably and ethically. So all the styling I did was, it was all sustainable, ethical brands. I made lots of kind of like quite tough decisions in the beginning, like I wasn't going to fly anything in from abroad when I was going to shoot. And, you know, I had a kind of like a checklist of things that I wouldn't do. And consequently, nobody really wanted to represent me. Because I wasn't like a commercial prospect. They were kind of like, what would you do if we got you a job for X brand? And I was like, well, if they don't resonate with my values, I wouldn't work, I wouldn't do it, I wouldn't do the job. As well, wasn't an attractive proposition. And she was feeling kind of similarly. So we set up a novel, Novel Beings, as it was called then, which was an agency for makeup artists and hairstylists, food and prop stylists, and everybody worked as sustainably and ethically as possible. And we ran that for 5 years and started to become, we worked for the BBC and for Hunger magazine and for the Sunday Times and Ogilvy and like this whole kind of, and then lots of sustainable brands. So this real kind of plethora of different clients. But we started to become managers, and we're kind of feeling like we had all these amazing artists on our books and sort of feeling like we were, so we put them into a different platform
Did
and
you
we.
feel that it drained your creativity a little bit? Like managing people, did it?
And I think it's this is the interesting thing that nobody tells you when you're studying, that you kind of like your a lot there will be elements of your career that feel like experiments while you're sort of like trying to work out what you do and don't want to do. And yeah, I don't want to be an agent. I don't want to be a manager. I don't want to have that pressure of I don't want to have that. I didn't want to have that pressure. But what Candice and I do love doing together and do really well is creative direction, and concepts and consultancy. And this has sort of grown out of having the agency that we were being asked by brands to come and work with them in a variety of different capacities, other apart from oh yes, please do be in touch. Drop me a DM and we can have a chat. Yeah, so we've just organically, pun intended, grew into this new role and really loved it, and so started doing that, and then we run that as a creative space and a consultancy. She is wonderfully patient, my business partner, because I've been doing a lot of activism work this last year. So I've been doing lots of activism and kind of lots of campaigning against the mainstream fashion industry. So she's been very patient with me whilst I've been going off and doing that, but it's a real joy working with her. Yeah, it's a real joy to find somebody that you have an instinctive language and a shorthand with. And it's changed because we used to have a real battle on our hands when we started doing this with engaging brands, sustainable brands. Like 10 years ago, there were a lot of sustainable brands. They might not have been set up by a designer. They might have been set up by an NGO, someone who worked in an NGO and saw that there was this fantastic artisanal project happening on the ground and saw the beauty of the work and the hand stitching and the craftsmanship and thought, I can help this community by selling their product. How do I do it? And didn't come from a creative design background, but came from a real place of good intent. So there was a lot of work to be done with certain brands, creating a visual identity that would be just as appealing as the work that they had. And now what we're seeing is brands that are, sustainable, ethical brands now are really savvy, really understand what needs to be done. And so the work is often in a different space, in communicating their brand identity in a different way. So yeah, it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah, you feel like other than becoming slightly more mainstream, even though it's not there yet, what is the change of sustainable fashion over the course of the last 10 years?
Good question. I think that one interesting thing for me has been the way that we've described it and the way that we've defined it. So, and what that means to the customer and to society and how we kind of engage with it. So when I started, it was called eco fashion and ethical fashion. And green fashion, and then sustainable fashion came later on. And it was very interesting because ethical fashion, that was what always really resonated with me about it, was that you were choosing to empower yourself with something beautiful, buy a really beautiful product, to empower yourself, feel really kind of like special. You could also empower the people at the other end of the production line, and that's why I fell in love with sustainable fashion, because that ethical element was there. And what's happened now, we're calling it sustainable fashion. Often the ethics gets left out. So whether that is communicating to a diverse audience, not just staying in your kind of lane and your bubble, really trying to reach out and be as intersectional as possible with your messaging and your marketing, or whether that is, you know, kind of forgetting to communicate the wraparound ethics of what it means to be. You can't have sustainability without ethics, basically, is what I'm trying to say. And I think when as we've changed that language, sometimes the ethics has slipped away, and that really kind of breaks my heart.
I think maybe would you say that it is scaling up a little bit more, and then just with the sheer scale of it comes this forgetting about ethics and start thinking about bottom lines and, you know, just making it work.
I mean, it's really difficult because the bigger your business gets, the harder it is to keep control of your supply chains. And
yeah.
If you're not in control of your supply chains and you don't understand where things are being manufactured, and you don't you can't physically go and visit those factories, then, you know, you've really got to rely on a lot of trust to hope that there aren't abuses in your supply chain. I mean, it's really, you know, it's really difficult to kind of keep a check on that sort of thing. And I think that we are operating, it's really difficult for business. It's really difficult for small and medium-sized businesses to make a profit. And we are caught in a system that prioritizes profit over people continually, again and again and again. So in order to create a sustainable brand, you have to fight even harder than your mainstream relations, because you've got so many other considerations to make. So it can be really hard for ethics, you know, to maintain an ethical standard. I know sustainable brands who have been caught in that space themselves and have discovered that that their supply chain, an element of their supply chain, has changed hands, and before they know it, their product is not being manufactured in the ethical workshop that they thought it was, and they've had to kind of cancel that product range, communicate it to their customers, find another alternate space. And it's really interesting to see that happen in the sustainable supply chain, supposedly sustainable supply chain, and see brands be honest and open and flag this up, because it really highlights to you how many times that happens. And brands either don't realize or don't care or know do anything to affect that change. And it's, you know, I've spoken to a couple of people who folded sustainable businesses recently because they didn't feel they could keep it keep the production as ethical as they wanted to, simply because they couldn't keep control of their supply chains. It's really difficult. And I think, again, we're talking about problems of scale and economics here. So and again, back to what I was saying before, we've got to slow down production, we've got to slow down consumption. And that means we have to encourage our customer to buy less and to care more. And we have to look at how we're setting up businesses and the business models that we are operating in, and ask if they are sustainable for the planet, if they're sustainable for the people who are working in them, and if they're going to be ethical in that space. And I think when you've got a smaller business, you're doing smaller runs, you're creating clothing, you're manufacturing closer to home, you're able to keep control of your supply chain, and you're able to keep the ethical element of your business, you know.
Really, I think what really is a positive that came out now is that brands started owning it up a little bit. As you said, if there is a mess up in the supply chain, you would see many brands coming out and saying, look, we know that this has happened, and, you know, we own it. It's our mistake. We are going to work through it. There's just so many cases where you see you're buying from a company in Italy who is producing fabrics, and, you know, they claim that they're producing the right thing, and then you go to check in the factory and you realize that in fact you've been buying just a thing that's not even woven in Italy. It's woven in India, for example, and came across the ocean, and so it is even for smaller and meat producers, I would say that it's hard and easy in the same time, in the sense that they don't have such big product lines, and so they can control, they don't have so many supply chain links. So in that regard, they can control. But on the other hand, they don't have the purchase power to demand certain standards from their supply chain providers. And so it becomes a question of just being so active in monitoring and measuring all the time what you're actually buying. So at some point, it is exhausting, and it is.
You've got to become a detective, and you've got to, that's it. It's a full-time job in itself, just making sure that what you're actually getting meets up to whatever standards they claim to be keeping. Speaking to somebody the other day who discovered that they had been buying recycled polyester materials made from recycled PET bottles from a supplier in China. And it turned out that the factory that makes the recycled polyester, they are using new bottles. So they're buying the plastic bottles new from one factory, recycling them, downgrading them, turning them into this recycled PET fabric, and selling it again. And I've heard of this happening, but that was the first time I had first-hand experience of speaking to somebody. And the only reason that they discovered that's what was happening was because their fixer on the ground was having a very open, relaxed conversation with the people at this trade show, who were like, "Oh, well, this is how we do it," and told them very honestly. And it's what that tells us is that as sustainability becomes more mainstream and becomes more commodified and becomes worth something. The financial imperative to kind of rip people off is really, it's really rising. It's kind of shocking.
Just to say, because there is a comment here to say if we can save this life, just to let you know that all of our lives go on IGTV and also as podcasts under Quarantine Talks on Spotify, so you can either listen to a talk or watch it on Instagram in the IGTV.
Wonderful.
Just saying. All right, so I want to have a positive note to end this conversation with.
Lovely. Thank you. It's been a lovely talking to you.
It was great. I mean, thank you so much for finding time, and really, I think it was nice shedding light into what sustainability looks like now and what it can do to change our habits and the way we live. Hopefully better, and hopefully in a healthier planet. I'm feeling very optimistic, because I think after 4 months of quarantine, nature has revived in such an amazing and quick way that that I am certain that if we decide to turn it around, we can. It's just a question of taking that decision.
Yes, but we ha yeah keep the pressure on. Like, I'd love to just say to anyone who's watching this now or at a later date, like, we have to be active citizens. And in the same way that we have to, to stand up and be an active ally in the fight, the sort of fight against racism and the sort of systemic racism that we are trying to dismantle. In the same space, if we're just purchasing sustainable products, but we are not actively questioning and calling out and demanding change from governments and from big brands, and holding big polluters to account, then we're just as culpable in that space. We have to be active. We cannot be passive, when trying to live a conscious and sustainable and regenerative lifestyle. So I would encourage people to kind of get active. Get active. Become an
Okay.
active.
Super. So everybody, get active, get your shit, sorry, together, and let's get moving. And for the ones in the US who are going to watch this, vote. Now is the time. Oh, Alice, it has been absolute pleasure to have you. Maybe we can do it another time again. Touch base in a couple of months and see how we've moved the needle in sustainable fashion.
When it's cool.
When it's colder. All right, we do it in October, maybe.
That'd be lovely. Oh
Great.
yes, we have a big event coming up in October. I think the end of October, that I will let you know about, but it's a big sort of sustainable fashion conference.
Super, let us know and we'll be happy to also post and inform our audience about it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Alice. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.